This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Bill Ferraro is an assistant editor at the George Washington Papers Project at the University of Virginia, online at gwpapers.virginia.edu. Bill joins me live in studio. How are you, sir? Good to see you.
I'm doing well.
Happy Thursday to you, or we call it Little Friday. Glad you're here. We're going to talk about George Washington 200 years ago today. But before we do that, give us a Bill Ferraro 101. How did you end up in Charlottesville working on the George Washington Papers?
Well, it's a fairly simple story of academic progression. I grew up in South River, New Jersey, and that's where I went to high school. And then I went to Georgetown University, where I received my undergraduate degree in American Studies, and immediately went on to graduate school at Brown University, where I was fortunate to work with a number of prominent historians, largely did social history, 19th century history, which led to my first job editing the papers of Salmon P. Chase at Claremont Graduate School in Claremont, California. It's a long story how that project got there. I'll spare everyone that. And I was there for 2.5 years, and I finished a dissertation on town meeting government in Rhode Island. But given the Chase's involvement with Lincoln and the Civil War, I was able to secure a position editing with the papers of Ulysses S. Grant at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. And I was there for 14.5 years, and that project was coming to an end. And I was still very much mid-career and interested in continuing as an editor. And there was an opening for the Revolutionary War series at the papers of George Washington here at the University of Virginia. And I was fortunate to get the position. And I started working almost 3 years ago.
Terrific. Terrific. So let me ask you, we spent 14 years working on Ulysses S. Grant. Tell us what it is that we don't know. Like one or two things that you think most Americans perhaps don't know about Ulysses S. Grant or don't understand about him.
The simplest thing that people don't know about Ulysses S. Grant is that he was extremely earnest as a president through the first 6 years, really tried hard to do good things. And it was in the last 2 years of his presidency when he sort of had a complete reconceptualization of himself as a person. And he started considering himself part of the rich and the powerful more than just a common person who was going to go back and farm. And he became very much the cutthroat politician involved with political partisan battles. And he became a much less attractive person. And in many ways, he was a much less attractive person through the last 10 years of his life till he got sick and then lost all his money in the swindle, not unlike the Madoff swindle that we have now, and recovered the fortune and the sort of the fame of his family by writing his memoirs. But it's that distinct personality change in approximately 1874, 75, I think, is something no one knows unless you spend time editing his papers.
So D.C. like politics could do it to a man even then.
Right. Well, and rich people. He really got himself enamored of the wealthy and the lifestyle of the wealthy. And I'm working on a short biography of Grant where I hope to lay this out in some detail,
because this is interesting.
All the biographers just don't pay any heed. And then secondly, he had a much more active life after he left the presidency than most people think. Most people think he just sat around and did very little until he lost all his money. But he was a very active person, really the first great international celebrity of the United States.
Interesting, really. Okay. Right. We're talking with Bill Ferraro, an assistant editor at the George Washington Papers. Now let's talk about George Washington. Take us back 200 years ago today, March 19th, 1779. Where is George Washington and what's going on in his life?
Right. On that day, George Washington is in Middlebrook, New Jersey, which was the site of the Continental Army's winter encampment, where he had established most of the soldiers in the late fall, early winter of 1778 and 1779. Washington himself is in a house which still exists today called the Wallace House, and it's in present-day Somerville, New Jersey, which is in Somerset County, rather near New Brunswick, near the Raritan River. And he's in this house with his staff and his aides, and Martha Washington is there as well. And it's very interesting that this is a rather small house to be monitoring all the activities of the army and the various political and diplomatic activities Washington was also called upon to pay attention to. But there's four bedrooms. In one of the bedrooms, George and Martha have their suite. Another bedroom is given over to his several aides and secretaries, of whom there are about 4 to 6 at any given time through the winter. The owners of the house, John and Mary Wallace, are in another bedroom. And this is the interesting thing, that through the research on the volume that this information came out, which is Revolutionary War 19, which will be published next year, is going to go in final copy editing now. So we find out that there was a 98-year-old woman, the mother-in-law of John Wallace, was in the other bedroom. And no one ever has any idea that through this winter, when Washington is doing all sorts of planning, dealing with all sorts of army issues, political issues, every day he has to walk by and be dealing with evidently a very sprightly and healthy 98-year-old woman. Now, when I was able to visit this house and talk to the curator there, he told me a story without able to provide documents to support this, but that Martha wanted that fourth bedroom for her day room. And she made an appeal to
a little private place you could get away.
Exactly, yeah. Get away or to receive visitors on her own, because there just wasn't room in the house for herself. She had to stay in that bedroom, and this was a private space, not a public space. She wanted to have a public space. And the proposition was made to John Wallace, and evidently had some relatives in nearby, but the decision was made that no, they were not going to move Mom out. And so whether Martha was upset or whether George was upset or how he dealt with this, it's hard to say.
So he's having to deal with that at the same time he's trying to figure out how to win freedom for the colonies.
Exactly right. You have this incredible personal issue and this issue of him having to deal in some civil way with a 98-year-old woman who lives to be 102.
Wow.
And her obituary is run in a Philadelphia newspaper, and it corroborates her life story in a way that we do mention that in the volume. But
yeah,
I don't have the sort of corroboration documentation to talk the story. But it's the sort of thing historians can move into the documents, move into the facts of where he's at,
yeah,
and then do something with it.
We're talking with Bill Ferraro. He's an assistant editor at the George Washington Papers. 200 years ago today, Washington is in that house. His troops are encamped in their winter encampment, so that they're not fighting.
Not
right
fighting.
Now.
You know, not actively fighting. He has patrol units out throughout northern New Jersey. There's other divisions of the Army up in Connecticut. Some are up in the Providence, Rhode Island. He's in communication with a large number of his subordinate officers. There's also other officers way out in Fort Pitt in western Pennsylvania. And Washington, this is something it's hard to imagine. He's just not responsible for his immediate location. He is truly responsible for the entire military effort throughout the colonies. And so he has to keep all of this in mind throughout the entire war.
How is Bill? I wonder how that's even possible at a time when there ain't no iPhones. There's no phones. I mean, the word that you get from the field could be, well, it's at least hours old, could be days old, could be weeks old.
And it is. And that's, he has to deal with that. He has to deal with the time lag. And this was one of Washington's strengths as a commander, is he was willing to give his subordinates, particularly the further away they were, the more latitude he gave them to make decisions. And he tried to set up broad outlines of what they should do, but he knew he had to rely on their judgment, and he would do that. But he wanted to hear what was going on. And so they did get regular letters, and he would assess those, and letters would go back out. And if it was really important, they would get couriers to ride hard to try to get that there quickly. Otherwise, it would go under normal military mails and might take weeks. But he was responsible, and he was very interested. And on this day of March 19th, there might have been others, because some letters we just don't know about. They haven't survived, but we can find them. But he sent out 4 letters and received 3. And one of the letters came from extreme western Pennsylvania, Fort McIntosh, by a general by the name of Lackland McIntosh, in which he's...
Great name.
Great name.
And Lackland McIntosh.
A very interesting figure, because he's the person why Button Gwinnett is such a valuable autograph, among the signers of Declaration of Independence, because McIntosh and Gwinnett were rivals in Georgia politics, and McIntosh shot Gwinnett shortly after he signed the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, wow.
Which is why there are very few Button Gwinnett signatures. He didn't live a long time. But he was a rather aggressive type and had some military merit, so they got him out of the South for a while, because he had a sort of cool things down, and he got sent out to western Pennsylvania. He had an abrasive personality, didn't make friends, and was shortly going to be relieved from there. But he writes a letter on March 19th, which Washington obviously won't see for weeks, in which he says, I'm going out to attack the Indians of what is now Ohio Territory, because they're restless, and we're going to see if we can subdue them. And Washington was very concerned about Indians on the frontier. And so McIntosh's.
And why concerned? Would they have a tendency to fight with the British? Or
they were fighting with the British. Yeah. They were hitting outposts and settlements, American settlements out there, and massacres. You know, up in what is now the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area, the Wyoming Valley,
sure, yeah.
particularly Cherry Valley up in New York.
I know exactly and where
this,
that is.
And this is a major
pretty
thing.
Country. Yeah,
this is what Washington's doing throughout this winter encampment. Is he's trying to figure out a way to stop these constant incursions of Indians and loyalists on the frontier, which is sapping morale, is causing the states to want to send their militias out there to protect the settlements rather than sending soldiers to help Washington and his army. So he spends an enormous amount of time through the winter trying to figure out a plan to check these Indians.
Yeah.
And this is what eventually becomes Sullivan's expedition in the late summer.
And he knew that if you send too much resources to the frontier, you won't have enough to beat the British right. on the front, which is, you know, on the eastern seaboard.
Which yeah. is really important. Now, even though he does make the decision that he was going to commit a lot of his troops to try to stop this, and he wanted to hold enough troops to keep the British in check in New York so they didn't do anything, but then to try to take care of this constant problem of the Indian and Loyalist attacks on the frontier. And this shows Washington as a planner, and that he would thought in this enormous fashion. And even again today, how can someone think this way? His initial conception was to have a three-pronged movement of one column coming down from northeastern New York, one column moving up from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, where he had his key army, and then another one coming up from Fort Pitt and converging in the area of Elmira, New York, which was the heart of the Six Nations, who were the primary British allies in the Revolutionary War, and to sort of destroy their villages and to threaten their women and children and force them to just have to deal with their basic structure, their basic societal structure. And he eventually kept the Fort Pitt people out there, realizing this wasn't going to work, because he spends an enormous amount of time just trying to figure out topography and geography, because it's so little that they know about that Pennsylvania-New York border.
Yeah. I had no idea that Washington spent so much time during the Revolutionary War figuring out how to fight Native Americans.
That's right. And this is where he was a strategic commander. He wasn't just responsible for the tactical activities of his army or the logistics of the Continental Army. He was responsible for the entire strategic activity of the war. And you know, it just shows how much he had on his plate.
Yeah, indeed. We're talking with Bill Ferraro, an assistant editor at the George Washington Papers. You can learn more online at gwpapers.virginia.edu. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. You got a comment or a question for Bill about the George Washington. Pick up your phone, give us a call, 977-1070. You mentioned that Washington wrote some letters on that day, and also there were ones written to him on that day again, this day, March 19th, 200 years ago today. What are some of the other things that were going on?
Okay. The one of the things that's interesting, and it's because one of the letters that he writes out is to Major General John Sullivan, who is chosen to head this expedition against the Indians. But this particular letter is interesting because it's so much more like the letters he typically has to write, in that it's dealing with squabbling going on amongst the officers. And what makes this one particularly notable, he also is writing to Sullivan to let him know that reports of mutinous spirit amongst his troops have proven to be false. Washington was unbelievably sensitive to any reports that there had been mutiny. And on the same day, he wrote to another brigadier general who originally was from Rhode Island, James Mitchell Varnum, who had in late January written a letter to Washington, which we don't have the letter, we only know the date of the letter from other correspondents, saying that there's a mutinous spirit within Sullivan's division. And I'm going to see what I can do to sort of squelch it.
And where was that? Where was Sullivan?
They were up in the Providence, Rhode Island area,
okay.
Which is where Sullivan's command was, in southern New England at different places.
So Washington sees any mention of that in any letter, and his red light goes off.
Red light goes off, and it becomes a huge problem later on. It has to do with the problems of pay, the problems of clothing, the problems of rank and rank dispute. And this was not a well-supplied army. and there were a lot of issues. They were calling upon their patriotism and their fortitude just to sort of stay in the ranks.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these guys didn't even have shoes.
Right. Big problem with shoes. Big problem with getting clothing that stayed, and blankets that were the proper sizes and were warm. So he was very concerned. Now, what's interesting is they investigate and he stays in touch. There's some back and forth correspondence. And on the 19th, they had resolved everything. But what turns out, Varnum's immediate superior, was Sullivan. And Sullivan was just incensed that Varnum went over his head to complain to Washington. And Sullivan says, why didn't he write to me? And I would have been able to either handle this or let you know there really wasn't anything going on. Instead, you were bothered and things like that. And so you had all this sort of sensitive remarks and this insubordination and following proper channels. And so Washington has to always manage that because he's got the personalities and the other issues related to his generals. And
yeah.
So he does write to Varnum saying, well, I'm glad this didn't turn out to be what it was. And it turns out Varnum resigned and went on to command Rhode Island Militia and be a representative in Congress from Rhode Island.
Yeah,
so he was on his way out, so I guess he could ease him out softly. But Sullivan, it's really important this time that he keeps Sullivan morale up and content because he had designated him 2 weeks earlier to be the commander of this major expedition against the Indians. And Sullivan...
So he needs Sullivan and his men to be happy and ready to go.
Ready to go.
And, interesting.
And so that's...
Bill, let me ask you this. Did you see I'm assuming you saw that miniseries on HBO about John Adams, which I thought was fantastic.
Off and on a little bit.
Did you see? I'm curious what you would think of the portrayal of George Washington in that.
I did not see enough of it to be able to say from direct
observation. Well, fair enough. Yeah.
So anyway, what I can add, and this is another important point of an incoming letter of where Washington was at. He gets a letter from the President of Congress, John Jay, and in the winter encampment, he's getting enormous amounts of letters. And it shows the importance of how Washington, as a military commander, had to take into account the government and the civil authorities. And so it was having to do with clothing and having to do with ranks and things like that. But Washington was very scrupulous in being properly subordinate to the civil officials.
That was one thing he was good at, I guess.
And he was good at it.
Yeah. And one reason they liked him, probably.
They liked him a lot. And he did it all the time, so they had increasing confidence in him, so therefore they gave him authority and they valued his judgment and discretion.
There you go. Bill Ferrara is an assistant editor at the George Washington Papers, online at gwpapers.virginia.edu. Bill, thanks for being here. Let's do this again.
Okay.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.